The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi there, you are listening to A Diversion from Seneca, the first of an occasional series of chats with a variety of fascinating guests talking to me, Jeremy Goldcorn, about China and all kinds of other things. This episode took a few months to bring together. It was recorded in November 2020, just after the US elections, but it covers a subject who is more than 2,000 years old, the Chinese philosopher-statesman Han Fei. He lived 280 to 233 BC. But his ideas seem so much more relevant to understanding China today than, say, the more famous Analects of Confucius or the ideas in The Art of War by Sun Tzu. Before we begin the conversation, let me give a quick plug for SubChina AM, our new daily newsletter covering business in China that goes out every day at 9 p.m. Beijing time, 9 a.m. New York time. Go to subchina.com/newsletters to subscribe. Now, on with the show. Jeremy Bame is a sinologist and historian, publisher and recovering academic who first went to China in the dying years of the Cultural Revolution, where he did manual labor, studied the works of Mao and Marx, and ate a lot of terrible food. He is the editor and publisher of China Heritage at ChinaHeritage.net. Welcome, Jeremy.
Kia ora, Jeremy.
Hi, and Jia Jianying writes, of course, for The New Yorker and is the author of several books, most recently Tide Players, The Movers and Shakers of a Rising China. Welcome, Jianying, and let's hope our technical issues are resolved this time.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for inviting me to this conversation.
Hi. Jeremy recently, the other Jeremy, recently edited and published a five-part essay by Jianying, titled China's Heart of Darkness, Prince Hanfei and Chairman Xi Jinping, which is what we're going to talk about today, as well as some other things. Prince Hanfei, or Hanfeizi, is perhaps the most influential Chinese thinker that most Westerners have never heard of. Stuffy old Confucius is probably the world's most famous Chinese thinker. Sun Tzu, he of The Art of War, is every Western business book's favorite Chinese strategist, while reputed author of the Taoist text Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu, is beloved of Western hippies and corporate speakers. I'd say I think that Mencius or Meng Tzu and Zhuang Tzu of the famous Butterfly Dream are on the Western world's B-list of Chinese philosophers and thinkers. But even less famous than the two of them, outside of China at least, is Prince Hanfei, who I might argue is perhaps more important than any of the aforementioned gentlemen when it comes to understanding what is going on in China right now, in Xi Jinping's China. And we'll get to Xi Jinping a little later. But first, can I ask you, Jing, who is Prince Hanfei? Can you give us a brief biography?
Sure. Okay. Hanfei is one of the princes of the state of Han, which was one of the seven states during the so-called Warring States period in ancient China, which, you know, this generally term used in Chinese among Chinese historians is pre-Qin, which basically covers a span of about 800 years, referring to the Chunqiu and Zhangguo, the period of spring and autumn, and the period of Warring States, which was a golden age for Chinese thought. Prince Hanfei lives towards the end of this period, which was about, 280 to 233 BC, as far as we know, because his biography was quite sketchy. But anyway, he's one of the prize students of a very famous Confucius scholar named Xunzi, which was kind of a Aristotle kind of a figure in charge of this famous Jixia Academy, where Han Fei studied as a young prince. But he kind of went in almost the opposite direction from his mentor, which was, you know, he became someone who synthesized a lot of other schools of thoughts thriving during that period, including Taoism and other, you know, military thoughts, and also these tacticians, and also based on the earlier legalist thinkers such as Lord Shang, you know, Shang Yang, who was a very influential and important thinker and as the architect of reform for the state of Qin. And so Han Fei basically synthesized a lot of these and debunked Confucianism, you know, wrote this master work called Han Fei Zi, which it became the foundational text for a mature version of legalist thinking.
And Jing, sorry to interrupt, but could we define legalism, since that really is what we're talking about? What does it mean?
Okay, legalism, I mean, it was often misunderstood with the rule of law, but it really is radically different from that. It sort of was rooted in the earlier version of the so-called legalist thinking, though the term was, you know, used much later, which was, you know, the thought that it's a way of governing a state through, you know, penal laws and, criminal laws as a more, you know, useful instrument for governance, which was, you know, before this, the Confucius thinking was, you know, using a set of rights as a, you know, the moral education at the center of governing the people, which is, you know, by, you know, sort of moral education or practicing sort of Confucius rites to instill, thought of, you know, proper behavior and respect for authorities. But the legalists thought that was really too wimpy and it's, you know, it's not going to actually lead to real obedience to the state. So, you know, the legalist thinking introduced a much more authoritarian kind of top-down way of rule, which, you know, started from the state of Qi, but then it spread to other states through the hands of, you know, like Shang Yang and Wu Qi, and then later, of course, through Han Fei. And it was really the foundational kind of philosophy for the state of Qin, you know, the king who eventually unified China towards the end of, 3rd century and became the first emperor of China.
What made you want to write about Han Fei Zi this year?
Actually, it started 2 years ago when I first published a New Yorker piece about this strange practice of Beiliyou, which, you know, that was a piece that came out in December 2018. And it was about how the police, you know, used this strange practice of taking all the dissidents out of, Beijing, the capital, during the so-called sensitive periods when there's a party, Congress or international forum happening. So they would take these dissidents escorted by a team of police, in plainclothes police, out of the capital so that they would have no way to speak to the media in town. That's a kind of a very Chinese style way of maintaining, you know, social stability. And so that led me to think about a kind of follow-up study about what is really the root of this peculiar Chinese style, you know, police state, and to track the sort of intellectual and cultural roots to this way of using law in the name of preserving and maintaining social stability, but really a more, you know, sort of ruthless way of cracking down on all forms of dissent and reining in all the, you know, rebels and produce a kind of a police state in the name of rule of law, and how that was manipulated and distorted all the way through different, you know, dynasties and all this to the present day of Xi Jinping, because Xi Jinping happens to be probably the first Chinese Communist Party leader who emphasized so much the use of law. And though, you know, with him, it was a complete, in his speeches and addresses, it was a real double speak. He speaks a rule of law, but in fact, underneath it, when I began to reread Han Feizi, which I did, you know, about 2 years ago, you know, I realized the connection between this archaic text that was written over 2,000 years ago really had been a kind of a hidden tradition, intellectual tradition, that has never been, you know, really looked at closely or, you know, taken very seriously by political scientists, or, you know, not to say outside China, but even in China, a lot of intellectuals often focused on either looking at the Confucius tradition or looking at, you know, the Marxist-Leninist heritage to, you know, interpret the CCP rule.
Let's get back to the question of, you know, what law means in China to Han Fei and to Xi Jinping and others a little later. But Jeremy, can I ask you, why did you want to edit and publish Jing's essay? And, you know, to the two of you, how did this come together on China heritage?
Oh, well, I should say that Jian Ying and I have known of each other and been friendly from afar, so to speak, as reading friends for over 30 years. But it wasn't until 2017 that we actually met. We both used to publish in the magazine in Hong Kong called Jiutianendai, and Jian Ying was very active there, as she also began publishing a great series of works in English about contemporary China and intellectual life. So I've long admired her work. And it just happened last year, in November 2019, Kevin Rudd of the Asia Society invited me to New York to give a talk. And the thing I addressed was really the things that were happening around the 1st of October, 70th anniversary of the People's Republic of China. And Xi Jinping had just released an essay on the 2nd of October about Chinese history, politics, and the future. And in that piece, he mentioned the Qin Emperor, and discussed a number of issues to do with this long tradition of autocracy in China. The Qin Emperor was a great favorite of Chairman Mao's. And in my talk, I mentioned the Qin. I mentioned Mao's obsession with the Qin Emperor, who was, in fact, enacted, operationalized Han Fei's thinking in many ways. And I said that Mao famously regarded himself as being, he said it, an expression he used, "I am a mixture of Marx plus Qin Shi Huang." And over lunch after that talk, Jennings said, "Oh, it was wonderful to hear this talk. I enjoyed it very much." He was very polite. And as we were all chatting, he said, "In fact, I wrote a piece about Han Fei and the legalists and the Qin Emperor and present significance of it for the New Yorker." And that didn't, they thought it was a bit too difficult for them to cope with. And I said, "Oh, that sounds great. Can you show it to me? I'd love to read it." And then over the next few weeks in November, December last year, Jian Ying shared her draft with me and we began discussing it. And I, being pushy, I just said, "Could you please expand it and add this and add that and so on and so forth?" And so over the next couple of months, Jian Ying expanded the essay. And it ended up being it's about 25,000 words now. And with the aim, I wanted Jian Ying to do it with the aim of publishing it in China Heritage, because I thought it's incredibly interesting and informative and important, but not that easy for big journals, Western English language mainstream journals, to publish. And Jian Ying very kindly expanded and answered all my pesky questions and queries and ended up producing this wonderful essay. So that's how it really came about. Jenny, I hope that's correct. That seems to be my memory of it.
Oh, definitely. I was actually delighted that by Jeremy's immediate reaction that he would he really likes this and thought it was important piece and he would be willing to work with me. And since then, we have had, you know, weeks and of constant, you know, back and forth, both, you know, discussion over coffee at, you know, New York cafes. And also, you know, after he returned to New Zealand, we also had many rounds of discussions through emails and telephones. And then, so as Jeremy said, it kept on expanding, probably three times or more, the original draft plus a lot of notes, which, you know, is, in fact, the first time I did actually footnotes, you know, as in before in sort of journalist pieces, you cannot really have footnotes.
So Jeremy can be a very demanding editor. I know the suffering.
Very pushy, very demanding editor, and he knows absolutely everything. So, you know, you can't get lazy for
it's very
for anything. And instead of being shorter and simpler, he's like longer, more complex. You need to, you know, go a bit further into this and that. But I must say it was such a liberating, you know, experience. It was delightful.
I'd like to just say, I mean, Jenny can address the issue of how of her youthful engagement with Han Feizer, and she describes it very beautifully in the essay as she starts in the prologue to the piece. But I should also say that my own interest in Han Fei and the Legalists began even before I went to China as a 20-year-old. In my 19th year, the anti-Confucius, anti-Lin Biao, pro-legalist political movement was going on in China, and it's one of the first things I read about as an undergraduate when I could read basic Marxist-style Chinese. And when I went to China, that was what that's the movement that was on. And so I read, my first Chinese comic book was about Shang Jun, Shang Yang, and Shang Yang's legalism, and Han Feizer, and so on and so forth. So from the very start of my life in the mainland, legalism and its history and importance because of Mao was part of the repertoire. And later people just dismissed the whole legalist movement, anti-Confucian, pro-legalist movement and its analysis of Chinese history. I personally never did because by studying at that time in my very early years and then paying attention to how after the Cultural Revolution they brought back Peng Jun and these other incredible, tough, what you'd call legalist thugs to run China's modern legal system, I realized that this long tradition was of great importance. Never wrote anything about it, but the minute that Jianing mentioned her work, I said, "Well, this is so important, how wonderful to have somebody finally addressing this."
So I'm going to try and kind of dumb things down to my level and then ask the two of you to expand on it for more complexity. How are we to understand legalism? And, you know, am I correct to use the Chinese word fa jia? Legalism and its relationship to what the Communist Party now calls rule of law, or sometimes is translated as rule by law, for which there are two characters, both pronounced fa jia, that mean slightly different things. Could the two of you sort of lay out the landscape of these words and how what the differences are between them?
First, I'd just like to say just a little word about this. It is a very complex world, but Jenning touched on that, on this, and that is with the rise of the legalist school of thought. And this is a school of thought, and Jenning goes into great detail about its origins, influence, and then impact on Xi Jinping. But it has at its core not only this belief in using strict regulations and laws that cover every aspect of social life, as well as commerce, as well as military life, as well as rulership. It also has inside it, in its very core, a spiritual dimension. And that is a belief, not only in the perfectibility of humankind, or man, to use the older word, but also that by correct regulation of a society, you're engaging in a kind of a spiritual, a numinous activity that is about coordinating human life in correspondence with the grand principles of eternity. And this, so the legalism, it's harsh and cruel and demanding, but it also is aimed at a utopian remaking of humanity. And this is one of the reasons it gels so perfectly with a Marxist-Leninist, and here I'd say Leninist, as well as the Chinese version of Marxism-Leninism, as Maoism, Xi Jinpingism, is this law, regulation, control, manipulation aligned with a certain element of what we would regard as being the spiritual, that is, aiming at controlling, uplifting, and transforming human nature and the spirit itself. And that's what makes it particularly difficult to grasp, because it's not just imposing tough laws and being mean and being cruel. It's also with the aim of doing that so as to bring about social perfection.
So it's not so much holding the ruler to account by impartial laws, it's setting a set of rules for the common people to obey in order for society to run well, and bashing them over the head with those rules if they step out of line.
Well, from the very earliest moment when legalism is employed, and Jenny can address this better than me, there's this element also that the ruler, the emperor, is themselves a morally superior being. This is why, because of their dr, which means both moral power and political power. It means power, control, and also morality. Because of their dr, they rule. And therefore, what they impose is for the betterment of everybody. It's the ultimate form of patriarchal control and manipulation.
So, Jane, can I ask you to tease out the difference between the two fajr and how we should understand them in Xi Jinping's China in the context of legalism?
After this Hanfei piece came out in China Heritage, I received a lot of, you know, different responses from readers. And one particular kind of stuck in my mind is that someone who said it was an American sociologist who said, you know, you compared, actually in the essay was just briefly compared Machiavelli with Hanfei. And he said, but, you know, Hanfei seemed to be much more cynical, whereas Machiavelli had a more of an idealistic aspect, which I think, of course, he refers to probably the Florentine republicanism that in Machiavelli, even though, you know, he's pretty cynical himself, you know, in the actual, you know, using of, you know, the way of, you know, maintaining power. But Hanfei's utopianism aspect is different. Of course, there's none of the republicanism in it. But I think his view of law has also a certain idealistic dimension in that he feels even though the personal virtues of the emperor cannot be, you know, just came by training, because there's a lot of despots, even, you know, before Hanfei's time, famously cruel and everything. But law is something that's so kind of neutral and could be applied uniformly by any emperor, even if it's, you know, you can't maybe mitigate the worst despots, but, you know, you can use law to rule a country, even with a lot of emperors or kings in Hanfei's eyes are someone who's neither extraordinarily virtuous nor very talented. But if you have, you know, followed this kind of uniform standard of law through the all levels of government, then even with, you know, the average emperor or king, ruler, can achieve a sort of a fairly good level of government where you have both social order and also kind of a strong state. So in that aspect, I think Hanfei himself is both cynical and idealistic, if you can put that. Also, he has a view of law that absorbed a level of Taoist element, which treats, you know, the ruling of the state through law as a form of art. So in the his, you know, quite large and rich toolkit of, you know, legal rule, Hanfei actually offered not only just these penal laws that should be publicized so that everyone knows and it's not just personalistic, but also a set of rules that the emperor could, by sitting in the palace, could actually use law and other tactics, such as, I mean, here, this is where you get a sort of prototype of police state, which through the hands of emperor, he can manipulate different levels of officials and underlings. So they have to follow a set of published laws, you know, not only following their own profit. And so, you know, in his eyes, I think it's a sophisticated set of methods in the name of rule of law, not just to strengthen the emperor, but also at the same time achieve a kind of fairly competent and good, you know, state of government.
So in other words, a way for a man of mediocre intelligence like Xi Jinping to rule wisely, if that argument is followed through.
Yeah, well, you can say Xi Jinping, you know, depending on how, which aspect of Han Feizi you're reading, he's a good student and also a bad student. I mean, because he really manipulates law so much for his own self-interest. You know, we all know the most, of course, the notorious part is he stripped the term limits completely. But also he often, you know, would force he and his men passing new laws, on the surface, they really seem to be passed by the People's Congress. But in fact, you know, he treats that as a complete rubber stamp. And he uses the party's disciplinary code internally to, you know, carry out his, awards and punishment. That's how, you know, he uses, the more, I would say, darker aspect of Han Feizi, the technical, the technical part, enforce this particular form of rule by law, or in fact, you know, that melds very, nicely with the Leninist disciplinary codes. So, you know, it's not just Han Feizi or just Leninist. I think it's amalgamation of traditional Chinese legalism with the modern kind of Leninist party heritage.
Can I just ask one more question about sort of the meaning of fa, of law in China? When Han Feizi was writing, when he used law, do you think he was aware of the sort of hypocrisy that we might read into it now, of an approach of using laws to enforce the authority and the power of the ruler rather than to hold the ruler to account? Is the ambiguity between the two Fajr characters, the rule of law, rule by law in contemporary China, was that a reality in Han Feizi's time as well? And we are just seeing a slightly different version of it. Or has the meaning of the word law in China changed because of the introduction of foreign ideas or for some other reason over time?
As you said, the introduction of what do you call? Well, you'd have to call them global norms of law, because the way the China was introduced was really to a great extent through Japan. So one can't just say it's just Western values. The ideas had been circulated through Japan to China and originated in the West, but this whole body of law and legal thought that in the Western tradition, i.e. the European tradition, traces its origins back in particular to Roman times. This had a huge impact on 20th century China and continues to be inform and engage Chinese legal thinkers to this day. The Communist Party, as you know, in the last 10, 15 years, has moved in various directions. In one direction, it seemed to be moving more towards what we regard as being a more modern, globalized version of law and legality. And that's why, in relation to international law and in relation to even those undertakings that the Chinese authorities had made with over Hong Kong with Britain, and the way that China was regulating itself in terms of a whole range of issues from intellectual property and so on and so forth. This is one of the cruxes of the great strife between America and China at the moment. But under Xi Jinping, we've seen a move back to, back on one level and also an advance, back to this sort of modern, recalibrated version of traditional legal thinking, which is in service of the ruling class and the ruling organization, whether it be dynastic or the Communist Party. And in that system, there's a pretense that people are all equal before the law, but that's not true. And the law is not something that is above or beyond the party organization or, in fact, the party leader. And that is something that is rather difficult to grasp, that the law is something that is manipulated by the party for its own ends, which it believes are for the betterment of the society. This is where it parallels what happened in the Soviet Union. Nowadays, many of the legal actions against dissidents and against activists in China really reflect the types of legal system that developed in the Soviet Union in the 1930s, the Voyshinsky model of rulership that was introduced by the Communist Party in 1937-8-9 and has been part of the tradition. So as Jianing was saying, this strange traditional version of law and this modern Western version of law along with the Soviet version of law are all intermingled and are a constant entanglement. And Xi Jinping and his colleagues, as you know, Jeremy, spend a huge amount of time in legalistic wranglings over how to not only impose law and police it, but how to write it all up and revise it and correct it. They're obsessed with the wording and the statutes and so on and so forth, even though the ultimate aim is to use the law, as Jianing was saying, for the sake of the party or the party's leader's benefit, believing that the party leader and the party are themselves the incarnation of history and progress and modernity.
And just to add one concrete example of that, I think it's this was one of the kind of prominent lawyers in a commercial law firm in Beijing who said to me about 6 or 7 years ago, he said, you know, if you really want to just distill the state of legal practice or law in China, you could just go with this saying of, you know, basically it's in Chinese is you know, 小案看法治, 中案看关系, 大案看政治. That means, you know, in small cases you have a level of rule of law, and which are usually very local, often commercial or civil dispute, that there maybe the actual legal codes can be followed or can be at least appealed to in the court. But the medium-sized, cases, which involves, you know, politics at local level and, you know, officials and bigger corporations or companies, you know, that depends on contacts, networking, meaning who's your backers, do you have a political, you know, a patron that can, you know, intervene. And then the big cases, which is the national cases, it says it's completely politics. Kanzhengzhi means, you know, the party, decides. And there's, really nothing. Following the law is just a piece of paper. This, of course, we can see in all these sort of show trials, really, of, say, you know, Bo Xilai or Zhou Yongkang, or the more recent, you know, case of Ren Zhiqiang, who got 18 years on the so-called, you know, corruption, business corruption. But everyone knows it's politics.
It's because he wrote an essay that offended the dear leader, Xi Jinping. I guess you can smell the same strong stench of politics in the midnight suspension of Ant Group's IPO. reporting soon after that indicated that Xi Jinping was personally offended by Jack Ma's speech, and thus the IPO, what was to have been the world's biggest IPO, was suspended.
Indeed, it was a wonderful illustration of, so you want to deal with China, you want to think China's part of the global community, you want to think it's just like, oh, they're just like us. You want to do what I call the kumbaya China. Well, this is reality. Wake up and smell, as they say, wake up and smell the coffee.
Right.
Let's talk about a few other things, but before we leave Han Feizhe, maybe I could just read a couple of lines of Jin Yang's. Reading Han Feizhe this time around, I no longer found myself bored. Instead, it was a disturbing and chilling experience. I shuddered at the cynical dismissal of morality in this ancient text, the paranoid mindset of its author, his misanthropic worldview. But I was also impressed by the profound learning, the complete absence of sentimentality in Han Fei and his unsparing honesty, his ruthless yet often brilliant insights into power, political strategy, and the fine art of psychological manipulation are a thing of wonder. That's quite a description of Han Fei. How do you rate Xi Jinping on the Han Feiometer in terms of misanthropism, paranoid mindset, cynical dismissal of morality, Jin Yang, if I may ask a cheeky question?
Oh, I think, you know, if you give an academic rating, he's maybe, you know, I'm very doubtful that he's actually read most of Han Feizhe. This is, archaic text of over 1,000 pages with text and annotation. But, you know, so there, I think I would say C minus. But, you know, if you put it into practice,
that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, I think he would have to be probably A minus, if I would say. Of course, we, you know, everything is still unfolding. We don't know how far, and he certainly, you know, we don't have time to go into specifics here, but he failed even by Han Fei's standard in several aspects, if you go by the canon, you know, of legalism. But in terms of how much he's already managed to achieve of, you know, putting every, you know, the entire Chinese officialdom and bureaucracy and intellectuals in terror of him, they all are kowtowing to the new, you know, legalist emperor. So there he gets, in my ranking, very good scores.
A minus. So does Chairman Mao, did he get an A plus?
Oh, Chairman Mao is above law, is above it all. He didn't have to bother with, you know, with the constitution. Yes, he's beyond the chart. Chairman Mao is beyond the chart.
If I could observe on Mao, after all, they still can't get rid of him. He's a man who floats above, now he floats above history and law and everything. He is now an eternal, you know, cultural figure like Napoleon in France.
And
he's not going anywhere.
I think Mao would be the mystic dragon king in Tan Fei's description, you know. I think compared to Mao, Xi will forever have to be a wannabe.
Except in one area, and this is where, you know, that's in practical political terms, this is very concerning.
That's true.
Well, two areas. One is facing off America, and the second is resolving national unity, the Dai Tong, the great unification of the state, and therefore Taiwan. And this is one area that I would imagine, I've thought for many, many years, Xi Jinping believes he can outrank Mao and do something that none of the other revolutionaries of 20th century China, in fact, because Xi Jinping is in a lineage of revolutionary leaders, not just Mao, but all of them. He will do something unique. And so that's of significance for people who follow China today.
And people who live anywhere near the South and East China Seas.
Well, the rest of the world, or the Asia Pacific, if I may comment from my own little perch in the world in New Zealand, it matters a great deal.
Oh, the Indo-Pacific, I believe, is the new Jeremy.
Oh, sorry.
Jeremy,
well, Indo-Pacific,
yeah.
I'm
speaking
Asia,
from
I know.
America, you know.
And I would say also Xi Jinping is a pretty lucky guy. You know, he has timing, you know, not thanks to him, but he came to power on the top of 40 decades of sort of Deng ushered in, you know, economic reform. So the state was fat with money, and also he's, you know, exploiting the current, of course, ongoing crisis in Western democracy, you know, and so in that aspect, he's a lucky fellow.
He was born with a red spoon in his mouth.
Mao did have to fight all those bloody, you know, battles on the way to power, both in terms of his theoretical, you know, enemies like Wang Ming, and also, you know, the nationalists and all that. But Xi Jinping just had to lie low, climb the ladder, the official ladder, and now here he is. You know?
So I would like to talk about two more things today. The one is your recent essay, conversation that was published, Freedom is Not Free in Chinese, with, I think, a partial translation so far on Jeremy's site, China Heritage. But before that, maybe I can just ask, there's been a recent outpouring of support for Donald Trump from various characters from China's dissident or anti-establishment community, ranging from Ai Weiwei, who's been retweeting conspiracy theories about the American election, pro-Trumpist conspiracy theories, as has, I think, Liao Yiwu. And there have been various articles about people like Wang Dan, the 1989 dissident who's been living in America, who has become a Trump supporter. What's going on with these people? I can kind of understand the new immigrants arriving from China. They don't like affirmative action. They've got their money and they want to keep it, and they like low taxes and all that macho business bullshit. But what is with people who oppose oppression in China and discrimination supporting Donald Trump? Because it's not just a few of them. It's an observable phenomenon. Jeremy, maybe you could take a stab at it first.
Oh, well, Jianing and I have discussed this a great deal. She has a very impassioned response. Being an American, of course, also helps. I'm not an American myself, and free of that type of emotional aspect of things, I have a slightly different view. And also I have a different view that's somewhat influenced by my involvement with the late 80s democracy activists and the 89 movement, and then having spent years studying the dissident community in America and independent intellectuals in China, and made a movie, Gate of Heavenly Peace, about the 89 movement, and then being dragged through 6 years of litigation in America by China's so-called goddess of democracy, Chai Ling. She sued our company, the Longbow Group, Karma Hinton and Richard Gordon, and involving me as well, for our movie. And that reflected already a sort of, she became a fundamentalist Christian reactionary, pro-Republican, conspiracy theory nutter. This is 10, 15 years ago. So I've had a long history of observing this type of both self-hate, this contempt for one's own impotence in a political process, that's also involved with what I believe is a complete contempt for democratic norms and legal norms. The belief that trained in China, in a China where legalist thought, a la Han Fei, has been around, in particular during the communist era from the 1940s, in which law and elections and ideas are all manipulated for the sake of power and oneself or one's group. And I'm afraid that I, very, very crudely put, and I don't read tons of the stuff about the Chinese Trunfen, they're called, the Trump fans, or the Trumpites. I don't read too much because it's just so sullying and so vile and beneath contempt. But it is part of a much longer cultural, political, and social matrix that goes back throughout the 20th century in particular. And we've seen it in many forms. And this is the latest articulation of it. And it's really, for those who are not familiar with this landscape, it's pretty breathtaking. Sorry, Jianing, you have much, much more informed views.
No, not much more, but because I'm partially feeling, you know, so outraged by this phenomena of so many, you know, raving Trump fans who have been my so-called Chinese liberal comrades of the last at least 30 years since Tiananmen. And so many of them have become, you know, the these super spreaders, at least on the Chinese, you know, internet and media, you know, of conspiracy theories, and also in the process revealing their own, you know, bigotry in so many ways, you know, racism, misogynism, and Islamophobia, you name it, you know, and then these are supposed to be, you know, a community of believers of universal values, 普世价值派 in Chinese, you know. So, you know, all of a sudden, now all the, you know, all of them seem to only really care about their own, you know, self-interest, their own, you know, failed cause of, you know, fighting for democracy in China or for their own, you know, rights of free speech in China. All of a sudden, you realize they really don't give a damn about the rights of anyone else outside that context. And in fact, they have such contempt, open, ugly, grotesque contempt for, you know, the civil rights, you know, movement, the Black Lives Matter movements in the U.S., about the, you know, the rights of refugees, and, you know, the rights of, you know, new immigrants, and the feminist movements, and they love this, you know, sort of, demonization of the so-called white, Baizuo, you know, white leftist, who were supposed to be responsible for the downfall of, you know, the great, you know, white Christian, West, which used to be so beautiful and now completely, you know, soiled and, you know, dumbed down by all these, stupid new immigrants and, you know, cultural Marxist, you know, who smoked dope and, you know, all came from the 1960s, right? And I mean, these are the people some of them at least, I admired, for many years. Some of them were, you know, dissidents on, you know, Tiananmen, and some of them were, you know, imprisoned, fighting for civil rights. You know, like, I remember this shocking moment. This was actually going a few years back in during the time of, 2016, you know, the first Trump election, first election when Trump won. And one of the civil rights lawyers in China basically used the word openly, the N word to call Obama every time. Is actually, you know, Heigui, you know, it's a black devil. It's the equivalent of the N words. And then every time you talked about Hillary, it has to be, it's the B word in English, but in Chinese, it actually was 老妓女, you know, old whore. And so a lot of these so-called public intellectuals already kind of smelled of their kind of male chauvinistic, misogynist views during the Chinese mini version of Me Too movement in China. It was just very limited, of course, as any, you know, so-called, you know, radical movement, it has problems. And I have problems with a lot of the, you know, PC politics in Western academias here. But that's not the degree of discontent we're talking about. I'm talking about the real heavy dose, ugly, naked, you know, sort of bigotry among the so-called liberals in China. And then all of a sudden, because they're so desperate in their failure of, you know, of the liberal agenda in China, which I have full sympathy, of course, under a leader of Xi Jinping, what else can you expect, right? But to, you know, project their, you know, failed, you know, cause, the solution onto someone like Donald Trump is just beyond, I mean, this is so surreal to me. I have to say, I view this whole thing with such horror, especially since the you know, the George Floyd protest. If you just go into any of these big WeChat groups, full of Chinese liberals and public intellectuals. And just to read the messages, it's just sickening. I mean, this is really not encouraging for anyone who cares about, you know, the spreading of liberal enlightenment in China. If these are the educators for the Chinese enlightenment, you know, we have no hope.
Right. Jiaying, before I slit my wrists, maybe I can ask you and Jeremy about something that may encourage me even more to slit my wrists, which is you published on China Heritage. Jeremy's title, Adieu China, Jianying Jia's Long Farewell, which is an introduction to an exchange published in Chinese originally, Freedom is Not Free, A New Decameron, an exchange with, is it Kato Yoshikazu, a Beijing-based writer from Japan. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I know it's also not necessarily the happiest of subjects, but hey, today is all darkness all the time.
Yeah, well, this book actually was 2 years in the making. I never imagined it would end up to be a tome of over 600 pages, and it just came out by Oxford University Press in Hong Kong. But originally, it was started from a conversation between me and Kato Yoshikazu in a Beijing salon. In Beijing, this was the summer of 2018. And there's a full house full of young students and young sort of liberal people in Beijing, all very anxious and confused, even though that was, you know, about a year and a half or 2 years after Donald Trump's election. And the U.S.-China relations were taking a radical turn for the worse. And some of the students, of course, were also worried about whether they would continue to have access to come to the West to study. And the liberal cause in China, you know, the American image was, you know, turning darker and you know, exploited by the Chinese government, you know, to rally the country around a kind of anti-American kind of nationalist flag. So I thought during that conversation was the first time I actually talked about my own, you know, heart-rending feelings as a Chinese who, you know, grew up in Beijing and romanticized America from my youth, from, you know, studied in the West, eventually become a U.S. citizen, had been traveling back and forth and feeling completely caught in between. And we had, you know, this passionate conversation with all these youngsters, you know, asking questions and everything. And that was the first time I realized perhaps this is the moment to talk about, you know, nearly 40 years of a personal journey that I made, traveled between America and China. And what does it mean at this moment to be a Chinese American and to write bilingually and all that. And so I have to say at the beginning, it was supposed to be, in my mind at least, a kind of a love song for America, you know, for my generation who was, you know, sort of, called Deng Ta Pai, you know, the school of the beacon, you know, we viewed America as our icon, you know, to become a smaller and smaller minority, in China was just, you know, such a heartbreaking moment. So at that moment, I wanted to basically tell the Chinese readers in Chinese, what does it mean, you know, to really come to America and then, you know, the journey from there on. But of course, as the conversation continued and Kato put in his bilingual, bicultural experience between China and Japan, and also with he also had spent a couple of years in the U.S. So in the course of that conversation, of course, we ended up talking more about, you know, also the mixed, you know, sort of message. I mean, it ended up to be a really re-evaluation about what America means. And what does it mean to be, you know, a liberal Chinese, you know, so-called, you know, cosmopolitan Chinese at this moment of time? So, I mean, we were actually ended up, I mean, also being critical of, you know, the certain, you know, deep-rooted problems America had. It's not just the ideal, but it, in reality, we have these you know, racist problems of racism, and you know, where I talked about the first 3 years I spent in the University of South Carolina. So I had a lot of actually really deep South friends, American friends who are from the deep South, some of whom are still my close friend today. And we how we discuss about the problem of race. And how, you know, I traveled the route from, you know, a very kind of simplistic, you know, kind of Chinese use, viewing America in a simplistic way to, you know, today that we realize, you know, really, you know, you need to be have this sort of independent, critical mind about any country, and you can't be a ideologue in any simple fashion. I mean, so anyway, I'm start to get rambling here.
Could I just put in a plug for China here? So Jianing very kindly allowed me to translate the introduction to this new book, Freedom is Not Free, that's just out this last week or this week. And she's also kindly allowed me to continue next year. I'm going to publish probably 5, 6, 7 more selections from the book about America and China, and about Jianing's perceptions and Mr. Kato's perceptions of things. And it's going to form part of the next year's China Heritage Annual. Each year I have a theme. This year's theme was Viral Alarm. Next year is going to be called Spectres and Souls, which is on America, China, and the various battles for nations' souls, individual souls, specters of the past, specters of race, and so on and so forth. So Jianing's work has helped inspire this new series.
Great. Very appropriately titled, I must say, Jeremy, because it is a soul probing kind of moment, and it's full of ghosts from the past, and you know, how do we really go on from here, because there's so much confusion and you know, misgivings about the present and future.
As Jeremy says, okay, Boomer, we're Jenny and I both in our 60s now, and so it's a perfect time to sort of look back and be lost in reverie while the young have to deal with the mess we've left them.
Fortunately, I'm rapidly aging into your demographic, so hopefully the Zoomers will sort it out. Generation X is obviously completely hopeless. Before we go, Jeremy, can I ask, since today, rather amusingly, the Communist Party leaked, quote marks, leaked a document spelling out the 14 sins of Australia, the things they've done wrong and why they deserve, you know, to have their goods boycotted and tariffed and generally have Beijing being mean to them. Did you read anything about it? And do you have any comment on China's new apparent adoption of Australia as its whipping boy, kind of not too big and not too small? It's kind of the Goldilocks of countries you want to make an example of, I suppose.
Indeed, years ago, when Fu Ying, now the State Council spokesperson, when she was ambassador in Australia in 2006, 2007, 2008, around then, China's strategy under Hu Jintao was to try and see whether Australia would be the bellwether place in the Western alliance, whether it could be flipped, to use that terminology related to American elections. And they tried very hard, and it didn't work. And then they got a Chinese-speaking premier, Kevin Rudd, who didn't turn out to be the type of easy the fall guy that they wanted. And yes, it's been a constant, you know, tussle in recent years and for decades. And there's a strong lobby in Australia to basically turn the country into a satrapy of China. It's I look forward to the 14 great crimes. Fantastic.
That was a diversion from Seneca, one episode in an occasional series of chats about China and a bunch of other stuff. I've been your host, Jeremy Goldcorn. If you enjoyed this, please check out subchina.com for more or subscribe to this podcast.